Welcome to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback Neuropsychology Podcast featuring tech legend Jay Gunkelman. He is the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience's NeuroGuide Workshop March 4th and 5th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Howarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu. Jay Gunkelman.
Morning, Pete.
Morning, Jay. Are we ready to educate the masses?
I'm happy to chat, you know.
What magic do you have for us today, my friend?
You wanted to chat a little bit about CTE at some point.
Yeah, because all this stupid slap boxing, I don't know why people want to watch this.
Yeah, I have an unusual interest in MMA. I enjoy watching, you know, one-on-one.
Oh, really?
Combat, you know, and it's the one-on-one. I realize, you know, this is like a really bad, like, profession to be in. And that quite often, well, in fact, pretty much without exception, they're causing themselves, you know, harm long term, especially as they go from just like neighborhood roughhousing,
yeah,
one on one to, you know, it's no longer a king of the castle, you know, wrestling with your buddies to get to the top of a hill.
Yeah.
It's deliberate damage. And
Dana White's the guy that
I know
does the UFC and all that.
MMA, it's not quite the sweet science, but you still, you know, you can block stuff, and you know, but it's not just standing there passively waiting for it. So the slap thing doesn't have any real appeal to me. I mean, other than just the freak appeal, you know.
Yeah.
God, look at those fools, you know. But
should they wear a helmet in MMA?
I don't know that MMA needs to wear a helmet. Some of the permitted blows, I think, need to be rethought. A knee to the head.
Like what?
A knee to the head.
Knee to the head, yeah.
That one move is a real severe one. And, you know, slap upside the head is going to ring your bell a bit, but a knee to the head can put you down and out. And, you know, they do have some limitations. If you're not standing on your feet, they can't knee you in the head. So if you have one hand down, you know, if you're on a tripod, they can't knee you in the head. As soon as you pick your hand up, boom, you know. So I think that the knee to the head is one, you know, knee to the belly, knee to the side. I mean, there's all sorts of knee moves that you could do without it being the head. So I think that one is something that they could reconsider.
What about the gloves?
Severity. they pick the weight of the gloves for the sport, and I suppose if they had a little more weight in the glove as far as the depth of the padding, basically, that it would cut down some on the intensity of the blow. You'd still get points for the contact, but you wouldn't necessarily cause the same level of impact. It's a brutal sport. The sweet science of boxing has been known to have dementia pugilistica, which, boxer's brain, punch drunk.
Yeah.
Those terms existed before football thought they had a problem.
More than their halftime shows.
Touche, touche.
Digress.
And it's controversial. You see, it's like art. It's, there's no accounting for taste.
Right.
Some people think things are fantastic, and others are simply wondering, why doesn't she have a safety harness? I know construction workers that are, steel workers that go up on elevated things, and they're looking to see if there's some, little wire going up from her in case she slips. And there's actually one of the dancers that did slip. So that they weren't worried about OSHA.
But we're talking about acceleration, deceleration, injuries to the brain. And like with football, these boxers later on in life, they get CTE. What is CTE? And then why do a lot of these, I just know Junior Sal for throwing one out there, why do they kill themselves? Like what does CTE do to get?
Well, as you see what you have been in the rearview mirror, and you see what you are in the mirror, and you see where you're going in your mind's eye, there are some people that just don't want to get there. It's always your choice. It's not a easy choice. It shouldn't be a first choice by any means, but it's everybody's choice as to when they want to end their trip.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be CTE. You've seen people with Parkinson's. They have the tremor and the shuffle and all of that.
Right.
Well, that's not quite as bad as some of the other dementias, which can have you progressing with your tremor and frozen postures and getting worse and hallucinating and having delusions. And then you get better, and then you get bad again, and then you get better again, and then you get bad again. And you can see it's getting worse. And Robin Williams ended up doing himself in, and it wasn't Parkinson's. It wasn't a simple movement disorder. There was psychosis added on top of it. And if you realize, gee, I was a pro player, I did have my head hit quite often. I remember having seeing stars and having my bell rung and kind of wondering what day it was and where I was and what was up. And I'm no longer playing, but now I've got memory problems and my mood's not so good. Level one, there's four levels of severity, and the severity on CTE starts with really, really minor things. And you could think, well, this is just me getting old. Yeah, you get old, your memory gets a little fritzy, and you get old and grumpy. Get off my lawn, it gets worse than that. And as people's ability to regulate themselves and their ability to perceive accurately and their social skill set, if you can't react and relate to your friends and family anymore, there's a point at which you're just, it's too much, and you realize it's going to be worse and worse and worse. And And the images of it are absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, what are the when your head when your brain is while you're looking that up, Jay, when your brain's sloshing around in there, you have chemical changes going on, right?
Oh
That lead
yeah.
to and the brain turns like icky brown and all that out.
Yeah. There's a tau, which is a protein, and it's associated with dementias as well. But they can differentiate slightly the dementia tau from CTE related tau foldings. And the structural degradation, this is level one. And you might see a little brown dot there. And this isn't a very dramatic change. Level two, you can see a little bit more of the dark changes here. And these are perivascular, peri meaning like above or adjacent to. And so that the plaques and tangles of Alzheimer's are not in the same, they don't attack the same situation, not the same same locations. Level three, by this time you're pretty well demented. You're not intact functionally. The temporal lobes are starting to degrade rather badly. And by the time you're at level four, you're really non-functional. Your cognitive function, your ability to remember, your ability to predict, your ability to understand, and about the time people talk to you and you can't really understand what they're saying, you've got more going on in your head than is coming in. This is so non-functional. This is a distinct endpoint, and they may simply die of the CTE. Not everybody kills themselves with CTE, and they degrade, and your brain has to regulate and function. And at some point, when they do pass, now you can take their brain to the Boston Brain Bank and actually have the CTE diagnosed. CTE is not di you can't diagnose CTE by, looking in
When
your
you're alive.
eyes or, looking down your throat with a scope or looking in your ears or asking questions. You can make a pretty good guess. Yeah, you had history of, a chronic traumatic, circumstance and you're degrading your function, you can make a pretty good educated guess that it's probably what it is, but you don't know until you actually do the autopsy. And it's not a quick answer. They don't just, take a piece and look. It's about a 9 month to 12 month assessment from the time the body is donated to the time you get your solid answer.
Jay,
And
for the newbies that don't know what they're looking at, it looks like the brain, it's starting with the bottom and then it works its way down. What is the bottom like? Where's the front of the
well,
head, the back of the head?
you have some frontal and temporal changes. The temporal lobe seems to suffer particularly badly by stage three. The temporal lobes are degrading, and temporal lobes. Oh, what's the big deal? It's just something on the side. I mean, why would that be important? Comprehension, memory, disturbances in the temporal lobe can give you false emotion, pseudobulbar affect, where the emotion isn't really a real emotion, it's a false emotion. You can have the term fit used to be associated with seizures, but the term fit is used for a fit of rage, a fit of laughter. emotions that are not in your control. In fact, the laughter isn't even funny to somebody who has a gelastic seizure. And it's a form of epilepsy that your uncontrolled laughter. The same pseudobulbar affect can happen with CTE, with temporal lobe changes. Very similar behaviors to behaviors that are involuntary from seizure activity. And seizures are not uncommon in people that have CTE. End stage. I mean, by the time your brain is degraded into, essentially almost a scabby mass, you end up having a dramatic dysfunction that you can't think straight. You can't remember where you are. Like Alzheimer's, people who go for a drive and they end up in another state, not knowing where they are or how to get back to where they thought they wanted to head. And that's very troubling. But by the time they're in stage four, it's usually irrefutable that they're so disturbed functionally that they're basically not operating a normal human way. So, and it's highly unfortunate. It'd be nice if there was a simple scan, a simple test, but there's not. This is an autopsy diagnosis. But you know,
question, Jay. If it's, why is it settling in the temple? And then if you had an EEG, I would think that there would be something showing up that, because something's got to be going on in there.
Yeah, you probably are going to see something that's changed. But the difference is diagnostic specificity. You know, in EEG, we can identify migraine ischemia. We can identify post-traumatic ischemia. We can identify vascular change-causing ischemia. We can identify a vascular anomaly causing ischemia. So, but we can't tell one from the other, from the other, from the other. So it's very sensitive, but it's not very specific. So we could do a scan and say, yep, it's not working. And it's not working so bad that this is like CTE, but it could be like some other brain pathology. I mean, there are lots of brain pathologies that are not good outcomes. Binswanger's, subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. I mean, the Jacob Creutzfeldt disease, which is mad cow disease in humans, which ends up with pathology as bad as this as well. It'd be nice if there was a quick and easy diagnosis, but the techniques that you use of neuroimaging, like, again, you can spot the location and all of that, but you can't necessarily, you know, test the protein and fibril tangles and so forth. So,
but if you got a baseline, an annual baseline, like when you get your physical, would you see some type of change that maybe you could exclude all the other ones? You wouldn't know it's CTE, but you know, you could have run the risk of these particular, right?
Yep. You could identify nonspecific pathology. Basically, you could identify the functional degradation. But again, if you're looking for a diagnosis, you have to send your body in after you're done with it and have them, you know, put the stamp of CTE on it. You know, ultimately, a lot of the people that are end stage CTE that are still reasonably cognitively intact enough to have a discussion, you know, would you do something different? Would you do, you know, would you not do football? Would you be a banker or whatever, you know? And they say, no, you know, I had a fabulous life. This is a fabulous opportunity. I enjoyed the sport. You know, I missed the sport. it isn't like they want to go back and not do it. They would prefer not having that outcome, but they wouldn't choose a different path. It's important for, I think, the sport to end up designing what they can to protect. And it's kind of like in the rules, they're protecting the quarterback a lot more than they used to.
Right.
It used to be, you three guys go get him, you know, take him out. He's beaten us, so take him out. Yeah. And, you know, people would deliberately, you know, try and take somebody out. They don't let you do that kind of stuff anymore without penalizing you. When they see
we started talking about boxing. How did it go down with Muhammad Ali? Because you could see him degrading, but then turn into Parkinson's. Like what?
Was there a link? Dementia pugilistica and Parkinson's disease are hard to differentiate. There are quite a few boxers that end up with Parkinson's presentation that may not have Parkinson's disease, but the damage that they have is to the same structures. Dementia pugilistica ends up damaging the substantia nigra, and that is a basal ganglia, and it controls movement. By the time you show your first it's called a pill rolling tremor, the hand movement that Parkinson's has, it's called a pill rolling, you know, like rolling between your fingers. By the time you show a significant pill rolling tremor or the head bob tremor, 75% of the substantia nigra is already damaged. I mean, it's almost all gone. A few percent better, a few percent worse makes the difference between symptomatic and non-symptomatic. And oddly enough, neurofeedback for SMR is being done for Parkinson tremor. And they're having good outcomes with it. So, you know, it's not like you can't try to treat some of it. I don't know that you can reverse the progressive nature of it, but you can regulate and control the symptom presentation somewhat. You know, Thompson's, Michael and Linda, when Michael was still around, they worked with a woman up in Canada with SMR, and she had advanced Parkinsonism to the point where she would have frozen postures. You know, in Parkinsonism, it becomes impossible to initiate a movement. So you're essentially frozen. You can't make the next step forward. If you try, you may simply fall. And falls in Parkinson's, quite often the first time you get diagnosed is after a fall. So you kind of lean forward like you're going to make that step, but you don't pick up your foot and put it forward, you're going to end up on your face. So the frozen postures. Now, she was going to give a speech about, you know, her Parkinsonism and the treatment and everything. And as she got up to do her speech, she found herself essentially frozen on stage. And she kind of got back into state, did her little SMR, you know, internal, whatever you do to make it. And it's ineffable. I mean, we can't tell you what it is you do. But everybody that learns it does it. So obviously it can be done. And, you know, she unstuck herself and gave her talk, gave a little giggle. And, you know, I was frozen there for a second, and, you know, but, it's something that can be treated. Now, CTE isn't just, you know, Parkinsonism, but dementia pugilistic isn't Parkinsonism either. Dementia pugilistic is probably very much like CTE because that's the basis of it. Chronic, repeated head injuries. The question is, did he have Parkinson's or was this all dementia pugilistica? And there's no way to really tell, you know, they're not going to be able to go in and do an autopsy and differentiate dementia pugilistica from Parkinson's disease. If you have dementia pugilistica as bad as the CTE from football, on the other hand, you're going to be able to identify the stage four. That doesn't look like Parkinson's disease at all.
What is the turning of the brown? Like, what chemical changes are going on? Is it the taus? Is it the lack of oxygen, or is oxidation? Like, what's going on?
In fact, protein, they're periventricular, and deep in the sulci, you start to actually get dark black changes, and the blood vessels actually start to have neurofibril tangles and penetrations. It's a degradation of vasculature. It's a degradation of neural connections. When a spot in the brain is essentially functionally killed off by it, it depends upon what spot got killed off. Did you get rid of a rich club hub and make it almost impossible to recover from it? Or was this just a little spoke or a little hub that are less important? So, you know, exactly where and exactly what ends up changing, you know, which symptom you're going to end up representing.
Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide Workshop March 4th and 5th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops.
Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Huarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu.
They've recently done a series of autopsy evaluations on football players. They've seen the same issues in hockey. They've seen the same issues in other contact sports as well. I don't know that swimming is on the list, but you know, there's, you know,
you missed a backflip going the other way.
My brother's a backstroker, and he used to whack his head on rare occasion. But, you know, you get pretty good at seeing the flags across the pool and knowing exactly how many more strokes before you put your hand back there and kick, you know. So,
right.
And he was a good backstroker. He was recruited to the Naval Academy and is a backstroker. Yeah, well, my whole family was swimmers. I took third NCAA 1,650 meter in the North Central Conference. The two guys that beat me went Olympic. I've never been beat before until I went to that meet. And when we took off the blocks, you know, I could see them starting to pull ahead. And I thought, well, you know, you fools, I'll see you later, you know.
Well, the beard slowed you down.
I swam my own race and they swam their own race, but they were just faster. And I was way ahead of everybody else and they were way ahead of me. So I'm happy to see the concern on the part of the athletes early in their career. It's a decision you have to make early enough. James Thompson, Michael Linda Thompson's son, went to Penn State, and he got his doctorate, and his dissertation was basically on traumatic encephalopathy and sports injuries and repetitive sports injuries and how serious it was to have the second and third injury when, you know, one is bad, the second one's not twice as bad as like squaring it. And it goes up exponentially, the amount of damage and functional loss. But he did a very nice dissertation on it. He sat on a government advisory panel that advised the military and the U.S. government how to spend money for TBI and PTSD. I was there, Yuri Kropotov, Dirk De Ridder, and you know a bunch of folks were there. A lot of people tried to get in that wanted to like sell something to the government for the purposes, but it was by invite only, and they had Marines at the door. Unless you were badged up, you weren't getting in. One of the organizers one morning was got off the bus and he had forgot his badge, and he said, "I'm an organizer." He was trying to kind of push the issue to get in, and one of the other organizers saw what was about to go down. This guy was about to eat, you know, asphalt, and said, no, I got a car right here. We'll go get your badge. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, you know. So that just buzzed over to the hotel, grabbed his credentials, and came back. But the Marine was just about to take him down, you know.
And I don't know if you're in the mood for bad art, Jay, but if you are, just to draw up, you know, what's happening with the when you get hit and the, you know, the acceleration, deceleration, what's happening afterwards.
It's bad art time.
Yes. So
a lot of times, because you've got a head, and we'll put a nose on it here, and you've got a brain inside, but if you are accelerating forward and you suddenly hit something, some people basically say that the brain bounces back and forth, and that the damage, coup contra coup, up in front and in the back, is because of this bouncing back and forth. Others suggest that the curvature of the skull acts kind of like a satellite dish, and it focuses the energy to a distant location. And the question of which one of the models is accurately predicting the damage is an academic question. The observation that the damage happens at point A and point B is irrefutable. The question is it the brain bouncing, or is it energy focused? Blast injuries have started to give us a little bit more faith that the focused energy may be more important in blast injury than the bouncing of the brain back and forth. The blast injury literally has a force wave traveling through the tissue and gives you damage all the way through. It's not just at point A and point B. It tears white matter connections. White matter doesn't like to be stretched. The myelin sheath, if it's stretched, it usually is going to die off as a cell, the white matter in the cell. So the brain could bounce back and forth, but it can also, again, act like a satellite dish, which is focusing the energy to a distant location. Those are, I think, really quite clear. The other thing is that and you've got an insula in here as well. And this is bad art.
There's the midline of the
brain. But when damage occurs, it occurs at the edge of white matter and gray matter, and at the edge next to fluid and substance. That's where torque ends up happening. If it was all uniform, homogeneous content, it would just kind of have the force wave go through it. But as it goes through, and something is more resistant to movement than the other thing, they tear. So the border between white matter and gray matter, the edges around ventricular areas, And in head injury, it's very common to have periventricular white matter change. The ventricles end up being fluid-filled areas, and around the edges of the fluid-filled areas, you see little tiny white dots in the MRI. These are periventricular white matter changes. They can be from post-traumatic ischemia. Ischemia will give you these little white matter dots. And post-traumatic ischemia, migraine ischemia, vascular change with aging. If you're 50 years old or older and they see them, they usually say age-related or probably age-related periventricular white matter changes. But, it could be from trauma as well. Unfortunately, every head injury is unique. If there's twist involved,
like a slap or a cross,
if you're coming straight, if something hits you straight in the front, your brain moves forward. The Falk cerebri, there's a lining between the two hemispheres, and the brain goes forward and hits that dura lining, the Falk cerebri. And at that point, it damages the connections between right and left frontally. But if there's a twist involved, it tears connections through the brain. That twist ends up being, if your head is turned and you get a hit, the brain has a twist to it. And, you're running down the field in football and somebody throws you a pass and you're turning your head and you're receiving something and then somebody comes straight at you and hits you. So it isn't always direct hit. If you're hitting somebody, you may have your the concussion for you may be straight on, but the person you're hitting with their head already turned to the side, goodness knows what the physics for that individual is.
Is that more of a brainstem issue?
It can be. And the brainstem is pretty well protected, but at the same time, a damage to the brainstem is foundational to brain function. Breathing, basic existential function ends up happening in brainstem. You can lose a piece of your cortex and lose a little bit of memory of something, but it's not like losing something at the level of the brainstem. You're going to lose foundational function. Tumors that influence the brainstem quite often end up being fatal because of their negative impact on just basic function, breathing, respiration, maintenance of blood pressure, etc. So you don't want to end up losing a brainstem. Yeah.
You can't grow it back.
No. Well, you can't grow back cortex either, at least not historically. I mean, they're getting pretty fancy with what they can grow now. They're growing little miniature brain organelles. That they've implanted some of them into damaged brains in rats, and the rats recover. So goodness knows what they'll end up doing with the implants for recovery at some point.
All these injuries now, some you can see with an EEG, some you can't, but the techs out there, they're going to be doing neurofeedback. Like, what's happening? Like, what training is going on that helps reroute the circuit there to help these people get better?
Well, when you're training EEG, you're training the output of a very complex system. And if you know what you're doing and you train in the right spot with the right frequencies, you can end up influencing brain function in a rather amazing way. We've taught people that have had significant brain injuries how to recover their function in a way that they didn't expect necessarily. I have a an acquaintance in the Napa Valley that was kind of a semi-pro bicycle racer, got hit head-on zooming down a hill, and the stoplight at the base of the hill was not working, and somebody cut across his lane, hit him, just absolutely gouged this. He was wearing a helmet, and the helmet was just absolutely road rash, gouge gone. And he was in a coma for about 8 months. And his twist, because of the hit on one side, basically, was really quite significant. And you could tell he wasn't able to differentiate one side of himself from the other. If he's sitting in a chair and you roll a ball towards him in therapy, you're supposed to kick it with one foot, both feet would kick. You know, things that required you to crisscross, right, like the movement of crawling and things like that. He, anything that required crossing the midline, he just really had lost. Quite a bit of work. But he ended up recovering well enough to be generally functional. He has a little bit of difficulty with speech because the motor movement of his tongue is a little bit disturbed. But he's, you know, he's able to get out and about. He drives. You know, he's still existing well enough in his recovery, and. Robin Williams actually donated him one of those bicycles with a full TV screen in front of it before Robin passed. He donated him since he didn't have enough balance to ride a bike anymore. He had a stationary bike that could take you through the Alps or wherever you want to go. But the recovery is possible, but it's not easy. And it requires very specialized intervention. This isn't just a wait and recover. You've got to do specific things to bring the networks back online.
So. Hey, Jay, let's just say Dana White just happened to turn on the internet and just happens to see us. Would you have any suggestions, since you're a fan of MMA, like, what would be the protocols or procedures to make sure that there's good brain health for these people?
You just tell them to hold still, don't move. yeah. You know, I have to say MMA, you can actually block an MMA. This slap stuff is not sport. That's just stupid. You know, how bright is it to stand there and take one? You know, you know, where's the block? Where's the
right,
block?
Right.
I mean,
right.
In MMA, I do believe that there are things they could do to make it a little more safe. There are rules. You know, it's kind of an all out fight, whatever you want to do. But, you know, like the old boxing match, no eye gouging, no, you know, kneeing in the balls, you know, all the all the little moves that they wouldn't allow. Well, a knee to the head is one that they should disallow. Now, they don't let you do it if you're on all fours, or if you have one hand down. I mean, but it's time to just disallow a knee to the head. That one is a blow that is potentially fatal. And I think that's one where it just does, you don't have to make that move something that is part of that sport. And the weight of the gloves, I mean, how much padding there is and all of that, those little changes in these sorts of things can make a big difference. And I don't really see them feeling the pressure to make it that much safer. At this point, if somebody gets knocked out, they take them off to the ER afterwards and scan them and everything. But that's after the fact. I mean, you got to do preventative changes to the rules. And I have to say, you know, I have, you know, you'd think, well, I'm in brain science stuff, and I would be absolutely against sports like that.
Yeah.
But I, you know, one-on-one, mano-a-mano, king
knock
of the
me
guy.
Off the hill.
Yeah, that sort of stuff still has a appeal to me, and I realize that this is not a sport that I want to personally involve myself in, because you know I realize the damage that can happen, and the older you are, the less intact you are for this. You have to think twice about the same kind of an injury in somebody 45, 50 versus somebody 22, 28. You know, when your brain is all puffy and fresh, it doesn't flop around a lot. By the time you start to have some atrophy, your brain moves. And, you know, it doesn't take much to end up having a blood vessel tear and getting a subdural hematoma.
I just wonder if they ever could get to the point, Jay, where if it's the helmet measuring the G forces, or the way they're able to pick up things with, you know, with the new technology and measurements to do the EEG with nothing touching the head. You just have a laser, you know, pointing at it, and you've reached a certain limit, and okay, you're done. You can't take anymore, or you can only punch in the head a couple times. You get three connects. That's it. You have to go to the body. The rest. It's the only thing I could think of.
You know,
then nobody would watch it.
I think that's probably about right. You know, part of the attractiveness of the sport to people is the risk. You know, you risk a whack to the head that knocks you out, and then yeah, there are a lot of people that are disappointed if there isn't a knockout in a fight. So that's not me. A good contest could be a lot of good wrestling, you know.
Wrestling, don't even start. And then Jay, I'm sure you agree. I think we dedicate the show to Susan Othmer. Siegfried sent me a couple notes here. We'd love to have Siegfried on, and I didn't do a very good job in the family. I'm going to reach out, have him come on. I didn't do a good job of the Women of Neurofeedback. I like to update that episode because, you know, we weren't as sophisticated back then as we are now. And we left her out.
We're not sophisticated now.
we're getting there, Jay. But we like to dedicate this show to Susan Fitzgerald Othmer.
You know, our field has lost a lot of foundational figures, and Sue was foundational for a whole bunch of people. She had her own intuitive insights into things. Their early observations clinically ended up being validated later. I mean, everybody comes to see the elephants in the parade. You know, they're the interesting part. The scientists come afterwards and they sweep up all the poop from the elephants, you know. And so, she was out there doing a lot of good clinical insight. The going for infra-low frequency, the insight into doing that at all came from her. If you remember back then, Lubar was ZZSMR, FZ beta, and they are doing C3, C4, and then C3FZ and C4PZ. But the observation of SMR being an SMR effect better on the right side than the left side, that was all clinical observation. And it wasn't validated. But, you know, Andrew Hill actually got his PhD at UCLA's brain lateralization lab, Aaron Zeidel's lab, and he validated that observation. You know, they did beta and SMR training left and right, and got subjective reports, fancy brain lateralization testing, dichotic listening, and whatnot. I mean, it was a lab that was specialized in brain lateralization. Unfortunately, Aaron also has passed. Aaron Sadell. So, you know, the field is all getting older, and this is you know, it happens with every field. The foundational folks end up, you know, passing, but we passed the torch, and there are younger, sharp, bright students and grad students and young professionals that are picking up the torch and carrying things forward, and validating with solid research. The observation that the very slow training ends up influencing all the faster frequencies, cross frequency coupling, all of the detail, the science of what's happening during neurofeedback is starting to be detailed. And if it weren't for the foundational people in the field, we wouldn't be where we are. We're standing on the shoulders of giants, and we're happy for the view. And it's unfortunate every time we lose one of them, but it's nature. And yeah.
Well, we got to get Siegfried on, and we got to talk about Susan and get learn more about her. There's a whole generation that wants to learn more.
Yeah.
Jay Gunkelman, thank you so much for doing this podcast once again.
Oh, sure.
Keep your left up.
pop on in the morning and pop off about the brain stuff, you know. So
the NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter Applied Neuroscience and our silver supporter Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience's NeuroGuide workshop March 4th and 5th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now.
Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Howarter. She's at GHOWARTER@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu.